Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I found myself totally preoccupied with worrying about whether the kids were going to sleep enough, whether they were going to eat enough, whether I was doing it right, whether my husband was going to be happy enough, whether I was going to lose connection to my former self, whether I was going to lose connection to, you know, my art. Although all of that worrying, I didn't do anything to move the needle. Like, I didn't make any art. So it's like, that may be one sign, is if you're preoccupied by things that either are out of your control or are in your control, but you're not acting in practical ways to address that, then perhaps you're trapped in your own matrix of fear and of anxiety and or depression, however it manifests for you.
I'm so excited to welcome Julia Schwadron Marianelli to the podcast today. Julia is an artist who has shown her work across the country as well as internationally. Julia served as founder of and the assistant director for the Low Residency MFA in Interdisciplinary Arts at Sierra Nevada University, helping to provide alternative modes of non-traditional students to create sustainable lives in the arts. In addition to her studio practice, she currently serves as an artist mentor, workshop instructor, and facilitator, and is on the art faculty at Lake Tahoe Community College. Julia received her BA in studio art from UC San Diego in 1998 and her MFA in painting from the Tyler School of Art in 2003. She currently lives and works in South Lake Tahoe with her husband and two kids, where she continues to advocate for alternatives to traditional arts education. Her work is represented by Melhop Gallery in Nevada, and Julia has been a Crit Group mentor for our Crit Group Crew program. So I'm just honored to share more of her work and her life with our Artist Mother podcast community. And just, Julia, thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kaylin. It's really great to be here with you.
Of course. Okay, so let's get started by having you tell us something about your childhood that you feel like connects to your life as an artist today.
Sure. So there's a lot I could say about this, and I will try to say the most important parts. I'm the oldest of three kids, and I'm an artist. My brother's a musician, and my sister is a dancer and a dance scholar. So the three of us have been making art in some form. Together and apart our entire lives. And our parents are also artists, although neither of them pursued their art as their professional career. Our mother was a professional ballet dancer before we existed. And then she met my dad in college, and he is a journalist, he's retired now, but was a lifelong journalist and a trombone player on the side. So growing up, we were in Rhode Island, where my folks are from, until I was about five. We moved to LA, which was a huge transition. Mm-hmm. But we moved there because my grandfather, Abraham Schwadron, was part of the faculty at UCLA in the ethnomusicology department. And so I come from a family of musicians. He was a musician in the Marines in the band. And then he taught and studied music all over the world, wrote about it, recorded it, went and did field recordings that are, you know, a kind of scholarly things, or not kind of, they are. And so we grew up in this context where we were always playing music. My brother's the only one that sustained that as a pursuit for his life. But my dad taught us to play music when we were very young, and to read music. And I think that created this language that existed in a conceptual way And it was a huge influence for how we communicated with each other, with them. The other huge, besides my parents, who my mom continues to dance, though she's a career counselor by profession. And my dad, like I said, became a lifelong journalist. I think the thing that was a huge impact was my grandmother, who was my Ursula Schwadron, Abraham's wife, was a survivor of the Holocaust. And she came here because my grandpa liberated the camp that she had been in Shanghai, China, which is a whole long story for another podcast. But the point is, she got here and she basically taught herself how to speak and read English, how to raise children in America. And she was a third parent for me because she was in LA when we moved there. So she and everything about her, good and difficult, was a huge part of shaping us as kids and shaping me specifically. So I'd say work ethic in how that relates to being an artist. Now I can track back to her. She was also extremely creative. Mm. She had a closet of her clothes that was organized by color. And her, she was extremely like a modern artist. When I think about her closet, was like all this rainbow gradient of her shirts hanging perfectly on top. And then all her shoes in their shoe boxes, color coded. And just the way she organized her space was extremely influential, I think.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so many parts of that I love. The connection to dance and music and writing and sort of academia, like kind of enriching your childhood, and how all of those things, like, I mean, you didn't say that any one of those people were a visual artist, but certainly all of those things, like if you are a scholarly musician, then you probably have a deep appreciation for visual arts as well. You know, like all of those things just overlap so much in terms of culture and appreciation and kind of the people who are in conversation about those things and who appreciate them in their homes and as a part of their life. So I just imagine that was so natural for you to, kind of become a visual artist. But then, what an amazing story about your grandmother. And
yeah,
it's like you said, that could be a whole other podcast episode, but
it's a whole other podcast. But the thing that's interesting thinking about the language I chose to express myself in, I guess, is, you know, being surrounded by performers, my brother, my sister, my parents, I guess more so my mother, less so my dad, but I was and always have been an introvert. So I loved to participate in the family activities that included playing music. And we did do like youth orchestra as a kid, and I played the violin, not so great, but I tried my best. I liked to be in groups in collaboration with others, but I had so much anxiety about being the one in front or, kind of addressing an audience directly. So I think for me, visual art created a way for me to make, participate in this kind of conceptual language, but without having to be the front woman in the same kind of way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, speaking of, why don't you describe your work for those listening maybe who have not seen it before? You can talk a little bit about the mediums that you work with and your materials and your process.
Sure, thanks. My work, I'd say my recent work is primarily, it's all painting, and it's, I'm using a combination of acrylic inks and acrylic kind of fluid acrylics to paint on paper or paper mounted on board or fabric that has a particular preparation mode. Like I'm not hugely big on painting directly on raw canvas, but I've been experimenting with different surfaces because I'm interested in the way that, in particular, this water-based ink can sink in and then also stand up after a while of layers on top of the surface. And has, you know, different fabrics have different teeth and or whatever tooth, I'm not sure what you call them.
Yeah.
you know, a gradient of smooth to rough that I find challenging and exciting. I've taken a long time to come to this combination of subject matter as it currently exists, but essentially I'm starting most paintings with some type of text as the base layer, and often it becomes title of the painting. And it's basically me drawing that text onto the paper or onto the surface of whatever I'm working on, and then using that as like an architecture or a skeleton beneath the layers that come next. And the layers that come eventually after that are generally derived from the landscape, either directly observed from this South Lake Tahoe landscape or wherever landscape I'm in, or literally dragged inside the studio like pieces of the trees or rocks and used as still life for the same purpose. But I'm thinking about that as a combination of an internal landscape and an external landscape. And I'm looking for that vibration between those two types of experiences in your mind and in your physical body, when they jive and when they don't. I'm also thinking about in regards to the text specifically around ideas, words, kind of poetic references, sometimes taken from something I've read or seen or I've come up with it myself, but thinking about words that apply both to the human world, our man-made, human, woman-made, however you want to describe it, world, but also apply perhaps in a different way to what we call the natural world, and thinking about strange overlaps between those contexts and the way that human beings dominate nature in a certain way or require nature to be something for them. And what if we had a different kind of conversation? Those are thoughts that I have when I'm looking at whatever we call the natural landscape. So my work changed a ton because I recently, I'd say 10 years ago almost, we moved to Lake Tahoe from New York City. So that this work and these ideas didn't exist in my mind, in my work before now.
So interesting. I know this because you shared an artist talk on the network recently, feels recent. I think it was in the past couple months.
I think so.
But which we can link to that when we share this episode with folks. But just could you talk a little bit more about, I think it was a self-help book body of work that you would take the titles of the self-help books that kind of had this, like, again, this kind of irony or like humor when taken out of context, and you were using that text as the first layer of some of these paintings. Are you still, like, is that where you're still pulling text from, or have you started on a new body?
Yeah, not so much anymore, but it's, you're right to point to that as being one of the first times that I was really using text in paintings. I guess I did a project, gosh, I don't even know how long, you know, early 2000s, that was coming out of grad school, feeling a little bit just exhausted by all of the painting talk, because I went to a painting program, which I loved and was wonderful, but also I needed to like detox. And I just wanted to do something direct and engaging with people and people in the world, not just people who already knew about painting. And, or inside a gallery. So I started making signs that I wanted to give out to people. And they were made by painting, you know, in kind of painting the letters in reverse. In other words, instead of painting directly, I was painting the negative space around the letters and in a way to create a kind of handwriting that was in some ways referencing signage, but also referencing the hand and the possible mistakes and the slippage that happens there. Also more exciting way to create text, which is the same way I still do it. So those signs were just going out in the world, and I just leave them up on buildings and signposts and stuff. And then after that, I went to do this really great thing, which was I got to be a sabbatical replacement for a faculty member at the University of Iowa. And so I moved from New York to Iowa for this, what I thought was 1 year, it ended up being a 2 year position. And I learned so much about painting there and about teaching painting. But that's, again, another podcast. but the point is, Iowa City and the surrounding area have some of the most exciting thrift stores that I've ever been to. And
why is that? I feel like the Midwest is known for thrifting.
I don't know, but there, you know, there's just more space to store things. Mm-hmm. So I began finding these books. You're referencing kind of quintessential 50s and 60s graphic design titles at a certain period of self-help title history, like we all recognize probably I'm Okay, You're Okay, mm-hmm. Women in Madness. There's a few others that are kind of quintessential that I'm not thinking of right now. But basically I was acquiring all these books and looking at them and being attracted to the graphic design and to the color. It wasn't too much deeper than that. I just started painting them. Mm-hmm. And people would always ask me, so have you read the books? And I would try to read the books and they were terrible. Most of them. And so I was like, I'm not really interested in the inside. This is a foreshadowing for why I should have been interested in the first place. But anyways, I wasn't, you know, compelled by that. I was just kind of like, I want to use this graphic quality and then change it up by painting it by hand and creating an image of a book that is also a painting, and kind of thinking about books as windows and paintings as windows and drawing those mm-hmm. parallels. I painted this. There's a book that is probably not very well known, but is dear to me. It's called Secrets of Self-Mastery. And it was written by a priest, and it has the most beautiful, elaborate design, and has wonderful titles. I'm trying to think of some that are like, overcoming the dark opponents, just like these, who stand in the way, just these really dramatic kind of titles. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, but, keeping water in the deep wells, just these kind of provocative phrases. And I started making paintings, not only of the title, a cover of the book, but of several versions of it. And then the interior designing, like what I thought would be like a different version for each chapter. And so there are many paintings that came out of doing these book studies. But I got to the end of that when I had another opportunity after Iowa to go teach in Thailand overseas. And I thought that, okay, this work is going to be done in Thailand, because they're certainly not going to have the same idea of self-help and culturally what its use value is. And then secondly, I'm not going to find these books from this vintage anymore, because I'm in another country, in another continent, in another culture. But guess what? All of the bookstores in Chiang Mai are full of 70s era graphic design self-help books, because people go to Asia as tourists to find themselves and escape. I mean, this is a generalization, but there is a cultural tradition of this for Westerners to go, you know, sort of have this experience of looking inward, but really in terms of a Western gaze. So I kept finding the same books, and I painted those books in combination. And this is, again, like a foreshadowing to the current work, I guess, but I started painting those books. Well, I think I may have talked about this in the interview or the artist talk, sorry, that we had before, but I went to try to ask somebody in Thailand to make me a canvas, and I asked for one, and then he made 30. And so like I came and had 30 stretchers the same size, and I was like, well, I guess it's my show at the end. So it was cool, because I would just pick up one and put down the other, and they were basically book paintings next to aspects of the landscape that I was passing every day in this new place. So it was, again, like looking in and then looking out, but they weren't overlapped at this point. They were separate. And so I think that did actually, now that we're talking about it, kind of create the foundation for what's happening now, which is a much more direct intersection between those things. And it also is, again, using my own text versus found text for the most part.
I think it's interesting too, just the structure of the book sort of being an entry point, like post grad school, you know, when,
for sure.
I don't know. I think, you know, post grad school, you you kind of need a structure, right? Like, and, you know, certainly different phases of your art career, you kind of ebb and flow out of needing more tools or different tools or frameworks. But I think it's really interesting thinking about, like, I don't know, just kind of what that structure of the book provided for you and kind of allowed you to do within, even though it was just this like mechanism really for exploring painting and
I mean, it's also like it's a safety zone for me as like the child of academics or coming from that kind of emphasis on being a scholarly person. It was a, you know, verbal communication, written communication was always a safe space for me. Mm-hmm. So where maybe I felt more insecure as a visual artist, I felt like, oh, let me lean on this tool because I can speak about this tool. I can know this tool in a way that I don't maybe know what I'm doing in this other region. And where, frankly, like Tyler, when I was there, was an amazing program. And the faculty who were my teachers are still people that are my mentors now. Alive or dead, I still talk to them. And I feel that I got exposed to a culture within painting where we're talking about the world contained within four sides, which was a different, was like another kind of language translation I had to get to, because I didn't understand paint and think talking about painting in that way. And maybe it isn't super important to, you know, every person on the street, but it was a real privilege to get to learn from painters who were just so dedicated to painting. And then now I can really appreciate it, especially with distance, how that language is just amongst the languages that I have access to when I'm in the studio.
Awesome. Well, Julia, before we get into kind of the heart of what we're going to talk about today, could you tell me a little bit more about just kind of who you are outside of being a painter or a fine artist? I know you've had, you know, extensive experience in academia, but also, you know, as brought up in your bio, kind of are really interested in these models of non-traditional education and, could you talk a little bit about just kind of a few comments about your personal life and some of the other things you've been involved in?
Sure. Yeah. So outside of my painting practice, I'm obviously a parent of two kids. One is just turned 9 this week and the other one is 7. And so that's a huge part of my life, obviously, as well as, like you said, I've taught in multiple institutions, like for the last 20 years, basically, since I left Tyler. I taught at Tyler. I went to teach at Iowa. I went abroad and taught in Thailand. I came back. And when we moved to Lake Tahoe, I didn't really know what I was going to do as far as my work was concerned. We really came out because I was already about 6 months pregnant with Gabe, our first son. And Josh, my husband, had gotten an offer to work with a photographer out here who was based here, who he was really excited about. And it was a real job. At that point, we were both freelancing. We weren't sure about health insurance, just like all the things that you do when you're making that huge transition from being a couple to being a family. And my parents, really, who are still in New York, were very much encouraging us to take this job, knowing what they knew about starting a family. They were like, you need to get out of New York. You're never going to be able to afford a place here. Like, this is a great opportunity. And so we came out, and actually my husband is from Northern California. So he grew up coming to Lake Tahoe as a kid and had really fond memories of this region and would tell me all about it. I'd never been here. I think I'd been here once, not even to this area, to a different part of the lake for a wedding. But otherwise I had no idea what I was walking into. So when I got here, I would say, there were a lot of things going on, a lot of questions, a lot of stuff up in the air, as we all know, when we're a new parent or about to be moving to a new place. So I started teaching at SNU, which used to be Sierra Nevada College, and it's since transitioned to Sierra Nevada University. through folks I knew, through my network, friends who had studied in this area of the country, who knew people who taught there, who got me an interview to teach painting. And I started just teaching a class here and there. And then I met the person who ended up being the director of the MFA program, who had been teaching at SNC for a really long time. And he recognized in me pretty quickly, like, okay, this person would be a great partner with to create this new program. Mm-hmm. So that was a great opportunity for me to learn something I'd always wanted to learn, which was how to write curriculum, how to recruit students, how to make something non-traditional, how to make something that was, you know, attainable for folks who weren't your typical MFA student, who weren't, you know, in their 20s with flexibility and perhaps with, you know, not a direct, you know, any direct dependence or, you know, any of the sort of typical qualities that you'd imagine MFA students to have when they're starting out. So we got, you know, started, and that was, I think it was 2015, our first class began. They're still functioning now. So working on the program, building that program, administering that program, teaching that program, all huge growth opportunities. And the coolest part was that it allowed me an ability to stay in touch with, like I said, my extended network. So I was hiring my friends and colleagues from New York, internationally, from, you know, other contexts where we had worked together before and maintained our professional, personal connection. And so I felt like I not only was, even though I was living in this tiny town, I did have a way of being in touch with folks that otherwise I wouldn't have gotten to see. So that's one thing. And then watching the program and who it got to, who it serves, was another thing. This past year, I basically felt like I'd reached a point where I had given what I came to give to that program, and it was functioning and it's off and running. And I felt like that was really my mission there. And so I stepped down from my position voluntarily to focus more on my own studio practice and other kinds of ways of like teaching with you guys and teaching at a place in Reno where I can do small workshops, being accessible to the Lake Tahoe Community College community here in South Lake Tahoe. The SNU is about an hour drive on the north side of the lake. So this was, teaching at LTCC is a way for me to serve my direct community.
I'm so pleased to share that this episode of the Artist Mother podcast is sponsored by Annie's Kit Clubs. Annie's Kit Clubs brings craft and art supplies right to your doorstep. From woodworking to beading, knitting to card making, crochet, quilting, and more, you can join a kit club, and ready-to-go craft kits are mailed straight to your home on a regular basis. No prep work required. Such a fun and easy way to learn a new technique or gain inspiration by folks at Annie's who make it easy for you to try your hand at a new medium. Annie's Kit Clubs come packaged with materials and instructions for each project, so once it hits your doorstep, you can jump right in. I love this. Use promo code ARTISTMOTHER75 to take 75% off your first month of a kit subscription. Find out more at annieskitclubs.com. These kits would be a super fun way to get your kiddos involved in art and crafting without the burden of them going through all of your studio materials or making a mess with your stuff. Try out the Simply Beads kit to learn the art of jewelry making, knit your own socks with the Love to Knit kit, learn the art of crochet and create unique Afghan squares with the Afghan Block of the Month Club or their Moroccan Tile Crochet Club. That sounds very fancy. There's even a Young Woodworkers Kit Club, which would be so fun for kids, and a Charm Pack Club, which brings you 42-piece charm packs from America's top fabric designers. So once again, to get inspiration and supplies straight to your door, check out Annie's Kit Clubs and use promo code ARTISTMOTHER75 to take 75% thank you Annie's off your first month of a kit subscription. Find out more at annieskitclubs.com. That's AnnieskitClubs.com. Thank you so much, Annie's Kit Clubs, for supporting and sponsoring the Artist Mother podcast. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit and kind of go into a little more directly the overlap of artist mother life and some of the things that we've been in conversation about privately and wanted to share on the podcast. Let's start with giving birth. why don't you tell me a little bit about your experience giving birth, I guess to your first child or to either of your children, but just wanting to talk specifically about how that experience sort of influenced your perception of yourself and, you know, maybe this idea of like yourself as creator, kind of what that opened up for you as an artist, as a painter, or maybe what it, you know, what it shifted in you to become a mother and specifically to give birth.
Great. Yeah. So I wish I could say that giving birth was, I could like in that time that I equated giving birth with being creative. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact, I was not in the headspace to make those correlations. Mm. I was excited, you know, we really were, you know, ready and the birth was relatively straightforward. But when Gabe was born, he had multiple things happen in the first days of being alive, where at first he needed to be oxygenated. So like they took him from me and we were still in the hospital and they were like, okay, he's fine. Let's bring him back to you. And then when they brought him back to me, every time I would nurse him, he would projectile vomit. And it was one of those things where they were like, oh, it could be pyloric stenosis. It could be this, maybe he's just, nobody knew. Mm-hmm. And the hospital where we were was down the hill from where we live in Nevada, in Carson City, where he was born. And they didn't have the proper technology to do the x-ray that they needed to do to see what was actually, if there was a blockage or something. So anyway, we ended up having to go, they took him back away from me and we went to Reno, which is, you know, just another half hour away, but they put him in like one of those space age baby transport ambulance things. It was just really, really sort of shockingly, when I think back about it, because now I know he's fine. But at the time I was like, this is seriously traumatizing me. Mm-hmm. Just to, you know, not be able to hold him, not be able to be in the ambulance. We had to follow in the car. My parents were there following in their car. It was just really super dramatic. And so this whole time my mom's telling me like, you should get a pump. You should really get a pump. And I was like, I don't care. I don't need a pump. You know, I know what I'm doing. And then of course they keep him overnight. And I'm in some weird casino circus hotel in Reno with no pump. And I wake up in the morning and I was like in so much pain, as anyone who knows what it's like to not actually pump when you should pump. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, insult to injury. I like could barely walk. I could barely move my body. And so that's just kind of a funny story. The point is he ended up being in the hospital for a month.
Staying the night in the casino is like the funniest part of that story.
Oh, it's, yeah. You should have seen, it was like a neon hallway. I felt like I was in like a Fellini movie. It was so weird. Or like, I'm just like so out of sorts. Like, what day is it? I hadn't slept in 2 days, you know? And anyway, everyone was very nice to me, but it was just very confusing to live through. And ended up where they kept him in the NICU in Reno for a month and they couldn't figure it out. In the end, they ended up sending him home with some steroids and being like, the nurse, the head nurse at the ER pulled me aside at the end of the month and was like, listen, if he doesn't get any better, don't come back here. Like go to Davis, go to Stanford. We can't help you. And I was like, how long have you been feeling this way? Cause you know, anyone who's been involved in emergency medicine knows that it's like Groundhog's Day. Cause doctors change every week. So it's like, you just establish some plan and then Monday comes and they're like, no, tell me about your son. You're like, what? We just did this. So it was, so I think psychologically super stressful. And then there, of course, there's the staying up all night pumping and waiting to go back and sit next to his hospital bed all day. So I think the entry to parenthood, I know the entry to parenthood for me, and I'm sure for my husband in other, you know, in similar ways, but different, was traumatic. My folks were there who were wonderful. Josh's parents came for a bit and they were wonderful, but it was just like, the nurses were in the way of me doing anything. Like they were changing his diapers. They were, he had all kinds of stuff coming out of him. So I couldn't just have a kid. I felt like I didn't know what I was doing already. And it just basically reinforced that feeling. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm going to screw this up. If they let me have this kid, I'm going to screw this up. And so when we got back home after that month, he needed this medication and it had to be administered like 20 minutes before he ate, which anyone has had a newborn? What? How do you know when that is, you know? And like, what do you do with them while you're like holding them? They're screaming, they're hungry.
And then so, you got to wait for 20 minutes and then.
Yes. It was so stressful for me. And my husband tried his best, but as you know, as a nursing mother, you're the one that is physically connected to the child. And then the question was like, oh, maybe he's allergic to your milk and then maybe you're poisoning him. And that's the way, you know,
drinking milk and
Stop doing this, stop do that. And I think all of that, just all of the new parents, new mother stuff combined with the specific condition that I was, that was yet unnamed that he was dealing with. And that, and the fact that for, you know, his early year of his life, like I'd walk around with like a ton of burp rags on me at all times because he would just create like just rivers of vomit everywhere. So I was all, you know, just self-conscious about going anywhere or being anywhere for very long. And so I think it started some, it triggered something in my brain. And I don't know, I've never been diagnosed with like a particular diagnosis, but all of what I've read, you know, I think, you know, I just was already anxious and it made me extremely much more anxious. And so, you know, I remember in years later going back and finding a notebook that I used to keep next to my bed when we were sleep training him. And it had like the most insane notes in it about like what minute he woke up and what minute, how many minutes he cried and how many minutes, you know, and what I did. And it filled me with, I got like a wave, a return of the same wave of anxiety, just looking at that notebook. I just had to throw it away in the trash immediately. Cause I was like, I can't, I don't want to see that version of me. It's upsetting, you know? So, I think that it wasn't, you know, when my daughter was born, she was.
How far apart are they?
18 months.
Oh, you said 9 and 7. Yeah, so that's also to compound it kind of.
Yeah. I never quite dealt with Gabe's stuff. Like, I think I got through it and I was like, okay, phew, I'm okay. And now look, I'm pregnant again. We're going to do that do-over. And she was, you know, there were no issues when she was born. There were, you know, whatever the normal pregnancy stuff and the normal birth stuff, but she was born really fast and easily and didn't have any intervention in the beginning. And so we went along as normal, but I think I didn't, you know, then I had two babies under two. So that's a whole other world of, you know, complication and stuff. So I think psychologically, I didn't know that I needed to deal with what had happened, specifically in the case of Gabe's, traumatic birth, but also I think in the perfect storm of just leaving New York, leaving my network.
Yeah, the isolation.
To a mountain town. Yeah. My husband, God love him, you know, being kind of like in heaven, in this place where he really wanted to be, and me not wanting to disturb that, but also having these feelings of being, you know, confused about my identity, my community, and then my own loneliness inside, and anxiety about motherhood and just about who I was. Forget being an artist. I think I replaced every anxiety about the art world with parenthood. Like I just put it like on top of it and just forgot about, like, I don't think I showed my work to anyone here. And we have a huge community of friends who are so, so, so wonderful here, but it took me, ask any one of them, it took me years to let them in. And I'm not, I can't say that was a conscious choice, but I think I was protecting myself, and probably thinking I was protecting them from me, and all of what was unresolved. But yeah, so, I mean, there's lots more to say about it, but I, yeah, whatever you think is most compelling.
When did you, so you kind of had these crazy couple of years.
Yep.
Recently moved, a lot of anxiety, two new kids, home with them, set aside your art career. When did you, like, what was sort of the moment where you were able to process, like, what was happening and what had sort of become your life and how you were actually feeling? Because I really resonate with that idea of, like, and I know, you know, a lot of people do, with there just being this phase of your life where it's like such a blur and a fog, and you don't always like know what's happening until you kind of have this moment of like, oh my gosh, did I just spend the last 2 years like doing that? Am I depressed? So I'm kind of wondering about that moment, that first moment sort of coming out of that, where you started to really understand like what was happening and what you needed maybe, and how you kind of started healing moving forward. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but I really had to hit rock bottom before any of that realization stuff happened. I mean, without getting into the nitty gritty, I basically just started behaving in ways that were painful to my family, to myself, to my, you know, basically anyone who loved me, essentially. And I think that, you know, I really had to look at what I was about to lose before I got my shit together. Can we swear on this podcast?
We can swear, we can cry.
Okay. Yeah, I fucked a lot. I fucked things up. And I wish I hadn't. So it's not one of those things where you're like, but it's all, everything happens for a reason. Okay. That is probably true. However, I don't think it had to be as bad as it was for me to have recognized. I wish it hadn't had to be as bad as it was for me to recognize that I needed to get some help, some real help. I had been seeing a therapist in New York who I had been talking with since I'm 20. And she is a wonderful person and an extremely wonderful therapist, but we were talking on the phone and I was pulling one over on her. I was not telling her everything. Mm-hmm. And she became too close to me and we were speaking the language too well. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one thing I did was find somebody in my area who I was going to see in person. And she was someone not like me. She's like not an East Coast person, not, you know, somebody that could be my relative. She was like really Tahoe, blonde, super upbeat, very like, had started every session with like a meditation, which I was like, at first, I'm like, I don't do that. And then I was like, what? You need to do whatever this woman tells you because you need help. Mm-hmm. And giving over to her and to the way she was asking me questions and answering honestly and not being afraid to just give it all to her, basically hand off this burden that I felt like I needed to just hold all on my own, even though no one explicitly ever told me that. But I do think that being capable and keeping it together are things that are qualities of mine that I pride myself on. So admitting that I didn't.
Well, you've also been conditioned to believe that is what makes you valuable, right?
Right. Well, that, and, you know, going back to my grandmother, it's like, you want a real problem?
Yeah.
You know, so I was always afraid to share my inner life because I didn't want to be a burden to my parents. I wanted to do it right. I'm the oldest kid. I wanted to be of service. And mm-hmm. But basically the ways to be good in my family were either to do academically really well or to be really funny and entertain. And so, you know, those were the two ways to get positive attention. So those were the ways that I utilized, and we still do. And I don't think they're bad ways. I just think that they can't be the only ways. And I don't think my parents meant for those to be the only ways. I just think that, you know, we're all shown what we're shown. We're all mm-hmm. modeled what we're modeled. And anyway, I learned about myself through the therapist, through other therapists, through reading about what is a gratitude practice. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a really cliche and kind of trendy thing, but actually it's a thing that is really useful. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even familiar with it. Another therapist had suggested to me the idea of self-compassion. Did I have self-compassion? I was like, I understand the words you're saying, but I don't understand what does that mean? How do you practice right. that? Like, you know, and I'm a very practical person. So mm-hmm. you know what I did? There's a woman who wrote a book. Her name is Kristen Neff. She's a researcher in Texas who researches self-compassion, like, you know, as a scientist, not as a therapist mm-hmm. or as a social scientist. Mm-hmm. And so she wrote this book. I read the book, and she, in the book, outlines some actual tactical ways to apply it to oneself and studies in which it's been applied, et cetera. I saw she was having a workshop, and mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to go to the workshop. I'm going to LA, to Anaheim, and I'm going to go to this weird ballroom, and I'm going to attend a self-compassion workshop. And I did. And it was me and about 400 therapists. And, you know, I learned some things. I put myself out there. I found the ways that I learned best, and I used those avenues to acquire what I was clearly missing. Mm. And so that's why I say a foreshadowing, you know, I'm okay, you're okay. Well, if I had actually invested in what was behind those words, perhaps I would have started to learn this stuff sooner, but I wasn't ready to confront it in a vulnerable way at that mm-hmm. time. I was literally looking at the surface. So anyway, hindsight is 20/20, but as I began to open up all this new set of knowledge, I began to feel differently. And I began to have compassion for my former self and actually acknowledge her, mm-hmm. imagine her, look at her in my mind and think like, you were doing the best you could at that time. I wish you had not done that, but mm-hmm. you did. And now I'm not going to be afraid of stepping in the same holes again, because I've got this whole other way of seeing. And then it allowed me to be curious again. Mm. Instead of when you're like afraid and anxious, you can't think about what's possible. You're just trying to deal with what's already in your mind. Mm-hmm. The other thing about this is simultaneously, you know, getting emotional therapy, I was also starting to run outside. And that started after Minna, my daughter, was born. I would go for like 10 minutes, just look at my watch and think, I just run for 10 minutes out the door and come back. Mm-hmm. And then of course that got to 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And in recent years, I've been able to find solace and source material for my work through mm-hmm. trail running, which is abundant here where I live. And it also gave me a personal, though it's not, of course, it's not only me, it's many, you know, hundreds of people who do it, but it gave me what felt like a one-on-one access to the natural world where mm-hmm. I could take my own time. I could look at things through my own eyes, through my own perspective and acknowledge this landscape. Because people would ask me for the first 5 years, how's the landscape affected your paintings? And I was mm-hmm. like, I can't even see it. Mm-hmm. I can't see it. It's so big. I had like a weird barrier up. Plus, I don't know, maybe this is every mountain town, but there are a lot of like really hardcore athletes here. And that's a lot of the reason why people move to a town like this is to ski, to bike, to run, to climb. And they're quite accomplished. Mm-hmm. And so that was also intimidating. It was like, I can't just like go out there mm-hmm. and do the things that these people can do. And it's like, well, actually you can do what you can do. Mm-hmm. And you can find your own route through this place and connection to this actual landscape and to the people here. Mm-hmm. And so once I started doing that, you know, you start making different kinds of friends and different kinds of paintings mm-hmm. and connecting and not being afraid to show myself. I really think that that was huge. I mean, you know, not art making, but the art world in its kind of most superficial way trades in attention, visibility, originality, specialness. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of posturing and it's like a mysterious moving target. Like if mm-hmm. people are acting or bluffing to stay in the game or like where you stand or who's judging whom or if you should be judging yourself or not, or, you know, it's just, and then with social media, it's even more, mm-hmm. more of that way. And so if you can't, it's kind of in a way, not totally dissimilar from parenting. I mean, shout out to parenting as a pursuit. Like no one teaches you how to do it.
I know.
And you're supposed to know, what you're doing.
It's like the biggest myth.
Right.
That you just naturally know how to be a parent. I mean, I really believed that. It was something I was just going to know. I really believed that.
Right. And in some way, it's not, you know, I know there's been a lot of grief and I've experienced it myself around like how MFA programs don't teach you how to be a professional artist, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm like, let's be real. Like there is no way to be a professional artist. Like mm-hmm. it's kind of a miracle if you can make a functional career out of being a professional artist, really. Mm-hmm. And it's not because you're not good enough or, you know, it's not because there's so many factors and it's not like you're climbing a corporate ladder. You're right. Making the ladder at the same time as you're climbing it. Mm-hmm. And so there are some codified known strategies that I think can be employed and do work for most people. But I don't think that, you know, I don't think that it is something that it can be directly taught in the same way as perhaps preparing for other careers that what we acknowledge as such in our culture. So anyway, all of that is just to say that like, I think confidence and curiosity come through allowing yourself to actually be in that creative present. Mm-hmm. And that is the same as parenting. You know, when we're talking about parenting, it's like this concept, when you're able to have those moments where you're in it with your kids and you're like, mm-hmm. even if it's like, there's a tantrum, and that's what you're dealing with versus like a wonderful aha moment that you have with your kid. You're in it and you're like, all right, we're negotiating. We're figuring this out. Like I'm the one who is the pilot of this plane. My husband and I are in a parenting class right now. And that is one of the metaphors that they tell us. And I think it's really great. You're the pilots of the plane. How do you communicate with the passengers? Because right now they're not allowed to be the pilots. They mm-hmm. can't. Yeah. But you do want to include them on a lot of the you know, decisions of where you're flying and how you're getting there. So anyway, to get out of the metaphor soup, back to reality.
Yeah, Julia, let me just ask you a couple more questions about your experience with postpartum depression before we kind of wrap up, just because, you know, there's been podcast episodes where we've like, it's certainly come up in conversation, but maybe not as intentionally. So I just wanted to first, you know, just say thank you for your vulnerability. And just providing the space for others to kind of be seen through your words. I mean, obviously, you know, it's influencing me right now. Like I'm sitting in front of you, you know, having a hard time not crying. Because I just, Yeah. Like it just feels like I feel what you're saying, you know, even though my experience hasn't been exactly the same as yours. But so a couple more questions just about that before we wrap up.
Yeah.
What were maybe some like signals for you that like, I mean, you specifically talked about like kind of getting to rock bottom, but just a couple little signs maybe that people could watch for,
yeah,
to know, you know, like, is this something I need help with? Am I pushing too hard? Am I getting, I want to like provide maybe some signals or some reference points, for people to know, like, when might they be experiencing this, you know, or when is a good time to get help?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'll say, you know, this is just my anecdotal experience, mm-hmm. and I'm certainly in no way qualified,
too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. to give medical advice or support, but and frankly, you know, I did see my primary care physician during this time, and she didn't necessarily tell me, I think you have postpartum. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, for me, my version of it was my version of it. And, you know, a dear friend of mine who was the first friend I made here was due the same day as me. And we met in prenatal yoga, and she had also just moved here from the Bay Area. And, we share a lot of history in common just through our family history. And she's remained, you know, she was also experiencing her version of this. It manifested in a totally different way, but I think having watched her and recognizing that at that time, I didn't recognize that she was going through what she was going through, mm-hmm. either. Even though we were seeing each other every day, we were walking every day with the babies, we were talking all the time. We both needed support. And so it doesn't always look the same, mm-hmm. for everyone, obviously, like you said. So for me, somebody who, like we've said, like part of my definition of self at that time was somebody who endures. Mm. And it's funny now that I've become an endurance athlete it's not funny. I think it makes sense. And I found a place where that quality can thrive, mm-hmm. in an appropriate way. Mm. Emotionally enduring for the sake of it is not actually a healthy habit for me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how that was what becomes so rote in my life until reflecting back on this time. But I think I found myself, like I said, totally preoccupied with worrying, mm. about whether the kids were going to sleep enough, whether they were going to eat enough, whether I was doing it right, whether my husband was going to be happy enough, whether, mm-hmm. I was going to, you know, like lose connection to my former self, whether I was going to lose connection to, you know, my art. Although all of that worrying, I didn't do anything to move the needle. Like I didn't, mm-hmm. make any art. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that may be one sign is if you're preoccupied by things that either are out of your control or are in your control, but you're not acting, mm-hmm. in practical ways to address that, mm-hmm. then perhaps you're trapped in your own, mm. matrix of, mm-hmm. of fear and of anxiety and or depression, however it manifests for you. And that's maybe a time to talk to somebody or reach out to a good friend who's known you for a long time. I think, you know, there is a kind of a superficial way that new parents, new moms in particular, might talk to each other, like, oh yeah, no one ever, mm-hmm. sleeps. No one ever, yep. knows what they're doing. Oh, this and that, there are memes about it and this. But you know, I really, like, the small amount of sleep I was getting, I was interrupting myself, mm-hmm. with these fears and these thoughts and these notes and whatever else. I mean, my mom, I remember saying to me, like, the baby is fed, the baby is sleeping. You're doing everything you need to do. Hmm. And I heard her, and she's right, but it didn't save me from my own torture of myself. Hmm. And so, yeah, I really think that if that maybe that's one sign, is if you're not, you know, I'm not saying every new parent should be painting 8 hours a day. Like, no, but like, you know, I remember.
But that taking action, I think you perfectly described that idea of the vortex of feelings that, you know, kind of block you from growth, healing, whatever it is, sort of.
I mean, I didn't have like as much, maybe I had Instagram a little bit when my kids were little, but I didn't really start engaging as an artist on Instagram until much later. And, you know, I think social media can be complicated for people. So I'm not recommending that that is something that they should do or not do. But for me, in some ways, I kind of wish I had started utilizing it as a tool earlier, because it would have been a place that I could hold, you know, participate in a group like your residency group or something, where I'm holding myself accountable for daily practice or for a weekly, you know, gesture of some kind, and maybe help me feel less isolated. The isolation, again, was something self-imposed. In some ways, yes, conditional based on the fact that we moved, but, and I was away from my family, but self-imposed in the way that there were tons of people who were, would have been happy to hang out with me. And I just couldn't let them in. And so maybe kind of continuing to also hold yourself accountable for some social interaction. If you're not getting much outside of your tiny bubble is another strategy. Figuring out, you know, where your boundaries are for your limits of what's healthy and what's not healthy can be hard for folks who haven't started doing that emotional work before this point. And that's one huge regret I have, is just that, man, I wish I knew now then what I know now about myself and getting my own back. Getting my own back is really what I needed to do. And I didn't even know I should do. Never mind, know how to do it. So not waiting for, you know, anyone from the outside to tell me, like, either you're a good parent or you're an art, or you're allowed to be an artist, you know, like, I feel like, I don't know if it's just me, but, or my type of person, but it's like, we go through school, we go through these steps, and we're always looking for mentors to tell us we made the right choice. You know, you belong here. You've got what it takes, kid. You're going to make it. You know, I remember my dad saying to me, like, I remember sitting on his bed in high school, like figuring out if I was going to be an art major in college, and him saying, like, who's going to come down from the sky, God, and tell you that you're an artist? You have to make a choice. You know, and that scared me, you know? So I think that if I had looked at that more, earlier, it could have helped me have more confidence in my in all of my decisions and my ability to handle what was coming down the pipe.
What are you working on in the next 6 months or a year? Art goals and maybe personal motherhood stuff?
I'm actually, you know, just hoping every day that I can continue to be in the studio as much as I have been. This past 6 months has been amazing. I thankfully have the support of Josh and his, you know, kind of solid footing in his career here that allows us to let me be more flexible in the work that I'm taking on outside of the studio. But because I've been in the studio so much, then of course all these other art-related opportunities are coming up. And so that continues to fuel that engine. So I'm hoping there's a show opening that I'm participating in with local Reno artists next month. And as a part of that show, they asked me to participate in a billboard project where there will be four billboards around Reno featuring local artists' work. So that's been a fun new kind of project to design, since I've never designed work for that scale or for that perspective. So that's coming up. And I'm teaching again next quarter at the community college and doing some workshops in Reno at another space. And, you know, as far as my family's concerned, we've got lots of fun trips planned in the next few months. We're going camping. We're going to Big Sur, where we went last year, which is beautiful for their, they get like a ski week break. And, yeah, just applying for lots of different opportunities and seeing what lands, essentially.
Awesome, Julia. All right, let's close with our final five. Who is your biggest art crush?
You know, current artists, I've just been really blown away by just kind of hardcore paint handling by like Robin F. Williams and Julie Curtis and Carolyn Walker. They're all just badass painters. And that's been really fun to watch and exciting to just follow along. But classically, you know, Rosemary Meyer, who just kind of came back into fluctuation because of the Swiss Institute show, which I wish I got to say, has always been an inspiration. Joan Mitchell, you know, going back to original influences like Jasper Johns and Milton Resnick and those painters have always been kind of in my heart as a painter.
Awesome. Favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on?
So I dream every night about going back to Thailand where we were.
I kind of thought you were going to say Thailand.
Yeah, we've been saying, oh, we're going to bring the kids. It's been 10 years. So we're really, really hoping to do that. And then we also would love to be able to go live in Argentina where like most of my extended family is post World War II, and be able to actually live there with the kids for a year if we can figure out how to pull it off.
Wow, that would be awesome.
It would be.
A film or book that has inspired you greatly?
So maybe, I don't know if you've heard of Richard Powers. He's a
the
novelist.
Overstory?
Yeah. So yeah. He wrote a book called In the Time of Our Singing. And it's just a beautiful novel that interweaves like 20th century American history and music. And maybe that's my family's influence coming back. But anyone who has a musical background, if you read the book, you'll have an extra layer of delight because they weave in kind of a lot of musical language into a story about race, story about opportunity, about lots of different things. It's a just wonderfully written.
Mm. Favorite meal?
Oh gosh, this is a question I don't know the answer to, but I would say anything in Thailand.
That works.
Pretty much.
Okay. And just like to offer you the space to give a shout out to somebody who supports you in your work.
Yeah, there's so many people who I could mention. Number one, Josh Marianelli, my main man, my husband. I would be doing nothing of this sort without his support and his endurance. And then, you know, there have been some women artists who have just been my and men who've been my mentors for the last 20 years. Patricia Patterson, Isabel Bigelow, Ayanna Moore, Margot Margolis, and my teachers at Tyler, Donna Nelson, Jude Talashe, and Frank Bramblett. And a special shout out to Matt Friedman, who passed away a few years ago, but he was one of my most heroic champions and somebody who helped me get that access to the opportunity in Iowa that changed kind of everything after the fact. Mm. So I feel like if I can leave you all with anything, I just think the most important material I have acquired is just community, extended community across landscapes, across networks, across states, countries, national lines, just the artists and friends who I've met, who I've stayed in touch with, who've been meaningful friends and compatriots in this kind of weird world of trying to figure out how to make your creative life function. Mm-hmm. It's been more important, you know, my best friends from grad school, Becky Vickers and Arden Browning, Bendler Browning, just the people who I know who are still in this mix, trying to figure this out with me. There's nothing more important than those connections and the collaboration with like-minded folks.
Mm. Thank you so much, Julia. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
You're welcome. And my website, which I'm sure you'll link to. I know that Schwadron Marianelli is a mouthful, but I'm proud of that mouthful. Practice and I'll help you.
Yep.
Also, Instagram is probably where I'm putting the most current work on a more daily basis. So hit me up, send me a message. I'm happy to talk about the work or about any of what I've shared today with anyone who's interested. I really just feel honored to have had the opportunity to talk to you, Kaylin. Thank you for all the work you're doing.
No, thank you. Thank you for just sharing so honestly and for being a part of our community.
It's my pleasure.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.